Reset your system clock to 1989, set your toast to burnt, and join us on today's multimedia hyperguide tour of Windows 3.1. I'm your host, Super VGA, and in today's episode, I present a brief history of Berkeley Systems and their most famous product, After Dark. Well, can it really be only a couple of weeks between episodes? Okay, let's say maybe 4 weeks. Well, that's certainly better than 6 months or even a year between previous episodes. Recently, one of my software development contract projects has been winding down. That's been a port of a popular Windows adventure game that I'm porting to, or have finished porting, to the iOS platform. That would be the iPad and the iPhone. That's winding down finally. We're, let's say, kind of coming out of beta. I've got a gold master ready and hoping that this gets submitted in the next few days here. Well, that's given me a bit more time to sit down and write these episodes, and this episode actually started as part of the Simpsons screensavers development history, but as I was working, I was really surprised to find some really good primary research done on Berkeley Systems, primary research being, you know, interviews, one-on-one interviews with the people involved and who were there at the time. So I had to split up that episode into two episodes, and hopefully I can squeeze it all together in today's episode. As for, let's say, a state of the podcast, I've been giving this some thought lately. I've been slowly gaining momentum with writing and airing these episodes. Slowly meaning, you know, I've managed to actually squeeze two episodes maybe a month apart. The show for me has always been what I call an attack of opportunity. There's an old D&D term. It means that I always have episodes kind of partly written or planned. You know, I might do a little bit of screen capping or recording to get some initial audio done. Then I might, you know, a few weeks or months even later, write the history portion of the show. And really, the recording part of it is the hardest thing for me. It means finding a gap in my schedule to finish up that writing, record it. And it also means just being able to have a quiet enough place to do the recording in. Right now, I've actually moved to my little, I don't know what to call it, my little nerd dungeon. My wife, let's say, sort of agreed to let me split our bedroom into two halves. One half being the actual bed and furniture and other human living requirements. And the other half split, I think I mentioned this in a previous episode, split by this beautiful double-stacked IKEA library case, that Kallax case, is my little retro computing area. So now I'm recording in there, and it seems to be a little bit quieter than the rest of the apartment, and I've got my trusty, wonderful cat sleeping beside me as I record. Another reason why this episode in specifically got delayed was, sadly, we lost my 17-year-old cat. We had two cats, and we had two cats. Now we have one. She passed away last week. She was suffering from some pretty sad symptoms from her diabetes and multiple organ failure, and we put her down. That was a terrible experience, I hope. Most of you never have to go through this, or if you have, you absolutely have my condolences, because I've never been through this with a long-term pet before. I've lost lizards, frogs, reptiles of all kinds as a kid, but never, and fish too. I've done a lot of aquariums, but never a 17-year-old family member. So that was really tough. So my apologies for taking, this was supposed to be released a week after the last episode, and that just couldn't happen. Oh, and speak of the devil, he's awake. Oh, there we go. Let him out to go and have his lunch. So getting back to the task at hand, because this show was, like I said, an attack of opportunity, I just want to make it clear that I never intend to ask anybody to cover a Patreon for me or somehow pay for the show. This has always been a hobby for me. I absolutely love studying video game history and relating it to other people as well as I understand it myself. So if you want to see more episodes, the best way to do that is probably just to send me a little note of encouragement to kind of keep my eyes on the prize. It's easy to get distracted with contract work as a software engineer. So, you know, every little note, and it doesn't have to be like, you know, oh, good, you know, great job, VGA, keep the show going. It's more of just, I'd love to hear how you are engaged in the hobby, any sort of gaming history stuff you're interested in yourself, what kind of retro computing or retro gaming stuff you do, what kind of experiences you have, how did you grow up with these systems? So if any of that tickles your fancy, please send me an email, vga@vga256.com. That's vga@vga256.com. I'd love to hear from you. Okay, so what about the show itself? What are we going to do here? Well, I think I'm ready to change up the format a little bit. You know, I'm going to stick with, you know, the entire theme of the show and the topics we cover. But in the immediate future, I want to write and have what I call a DOS prompt episode. Yep, we're planning to drop into MS-DOS for a little bit of 16-bit gaming history and analysis. Well, why? You know, this is a show purportedly about Windows 3.1. Well, partly it's because I've actually been re-listening to Joe Mastriani's Upper Memory Block podcast lately. And, you know, Joe hasn't been able to record a new episode in a long time. And I see a big, happy, wonderful space that Joe used to fill. Joe's histories of MS-DOS gaming are still some of the best on the web. And no one has really stepped in to fill those shoes since he stepped away from the mic due to, you know, family related tasks. You know, I can't fill Joe's shoes. He has certainly had his own style of recording episodes. But I think I'd like to take a crack at some of the games that never made it into his recording sessions. Joe's specialties were flight sims and adventure games. And if you look at the episodes, that comprises about 90% of the episodes on the show, you know, along with the most popular stuff that everyone does an episode about, like Doom or something, or Castle Wolfenstein. My view is, my interests do overlap a lot with that. Like, I love flight sims, I loved adventure games, but honestly, a bigger chunk of my life involved RPGs. I absolutely love role-playing games, especially on the computer, and that's something the UMB cast was surprisingly, or let's say unsurprisingly, hesitant to cover. Each of those games takes dozens and dozens and dozens of hours to finish, and you can imagine how much more research time that involves with that too. So I'm unafraid of that, just for the simple fact that I've played a lot of RPGs in my life. I've kind of on the side studied their history as an adult, so I'm not too afraid of tackling that. Off the top of my head, I plan to write episodes on a few games. Betrayal at Krondor is one. I'm currently playing it through while simultaneously reading the book that was based on the game that was based on the book series. Try to figure that out. I also would love to write an entire Ultima series. Yes, and that includes Ultima Underworld and these side questy kind of games like the Worlds of Ultima games, Martian Dreams, and Savage Empire. I'd love to do an episode on a very, very atmospheric adventure game called Dreamweb. There's a space exploration game that no one's ever talked about called Nomad. And there's a ton of shareware titles like the Commander Keen series, Solar Winds, if anybody played Solar Winds back in the day. That kind of stuff really appeals to me. We don't have very good histories of those on podcasts, at least. So I want to take a crack at them. If you have a request or want to bump up a game further into the queue, please send me an email, vga@vga256.com. Honestly, you know, if somebody just makes one request, I'm happy to spend, you know, 10, 20, 30 hours of my life researching it and coming up with an episode. That's fun for me. You know, I can't promise that I'm going to do all of them in the exact order I receive them, but As long as there's enough information to generate an episode on, you can count on it. All right, so how about an inventory check? Last inventory check, I glossed over some of my latest finds just because that Ultima collection I bought from that other Ultima aficionado kind of broke the bank, and I didn't want to think or talk about buying any games anymore. Well, I did buy more games because I'm incorrigible and I absolutely love buying boxed PC games. Last week, the PC CD-ROM version of Ocean's Jurassic Park came in the mail. This is one of those 90s licensed games that was kind of largely ignored. There were so many other Jurassic Park games that came out around the same time for the Sega Genesis and the Super Nintendo. A lot of them were just called Jurassic Park. Some of them had more like Jurassic Park colon operations, something or other. I can't even remember the names of them. There were a lot of them. Keep in mind, you know, JP, when that movie came out in the early 90s, it was a huge deal. It was a huge deal. So there were so many licensed titles. This is one of those licensed titles that was actually really good compared to all the other side scrollers that were released. It's a mixture of adventure game that has some really, really fun kind of action puzzles. It's got some inventory stuff and inventory puzzles going on there. It's part arcade shooter, and even part 2.5D Doom-like. It actually has three different games packed into that engine. And the other thing that I don't think I've ever seen mentioned on any review is it has a fantastic Redbook audio soundtrack. You know, if you play the floppy version, you're actually missing out on a tremendously good soundtrack that's very, very different from the films. So I suspect we're definitely going to see that in an upcoming DOS Prompt episode of this show. I also got copies. I'm looking over my shoulder here, so that's why I'm turning away from the mic. I got copies of Microsoft Dinosaurs and Dangerous Creatures. These came in the mail quite a while ago. I don't think I mentioned them on prior episodes. These are gorgeous reference library / educational programs. And these all belong to a library of Microsoft titles called the Exploration Series. They're actually numbered on the spine. Dinosaurs is Exploration Series number 2. Dangerous Creatures is number 4. I'm currently on the lookout for the rest of the library. Number 1 being Microsoft Musical Instruments. 3 being Ancient Lands. I'm not sure if there's anything else after that. I think it might actually go from 1 to 4. There's some, you know, perverse part of me that I just really want to get all of those beautiful white and purple boxes together on the shelf together, like they belong. As for the programs themselves, there's something inexplicably beautiful about the UIs that were drawn in these early Microsoft programs. And I think I'd just like to cover each of these in separate episodes in the future, because there's something no one's really talked about this series. They've kind of passed them over as, let's say, edgy trash of the early 90s. And I think they're really, really good. They're very high quality stuff. They're extremely well researched. And I'm trying to look on the back of the box here to see if it credits the place that all the research came from. But I believe that this might have come from the Dorling Kindersley series of books. But anyway, we'll get to that some other day. Stick that back on the shelf where it belongs, along with the other edutainment titles that I collect. I also picked up a copy of Pixar's Typestry 2. That came in the mail a few months ago. This one's a 3D rendering program that specializes in rendering type, using Pixar's RenderMan technology. If you recognize the name RenderMan, it's probably one of two sources, either the Simpsons episode that was done by Pixar back in the early 90s, or more likely the film Toy Stories, well, film series Toy Stories, Toy Story. RenderMan was, let's say, the underlying render suite that was used to produce the images. Well, Pixar used that rendering suite to produce a, let's say, end user or consumer level program that lets you render text. It's painfully slow. Like, I mean, it means waiting hours for not even a very complex render at high quality on a 486. That being said, it's a very unique product. As far as I know, it's actually Pixar's only home or end user product that was ever released. I believe I read a history of Pixar recently, and they talked about the different products that they sold. This one is the only one that, as far as I know, was ever put in a box and sold at a store. I think it was incredibly expensive. I don't actually have the original price tag on it, but I want to say it was around $300 US for it. So not exactly something the average family member is going to buy. But it's a beautiful little box. I spent years and years and years trying to find it. And the reason I have it is because my uncle, who was, let's say, one of Canada's first web or graphic designers, professional graphic designers, had it on his shelf as a kid. And I used to goof around on it like crazy in his, I think it was a Pentium at the time, in the olden days on Windows 3.1. So I was so happy I could find an affordable copy of this, even though it took a few years for that to happen. That being said, I think I probably need to do an episode on this someday and talk about the history of Pixar too, because that's really interweaved into how Pixar Typestry 2 was released. And there was a Pixar Typestry 1, by the way. So I guess, you know what? There are two products that Pixar released for end users. And finally, on my shelf, I have Microsoft and Scholastic's The Magic School Bus Explores the Ocean. I picked it up completely, honestly, for its weird kind of, I'm trying to find it here on my shelf. I think it got shelved somewhere else, unfortunately. Oh, there it is. It's right behind me. It got squeezed in with Sim Tower and incredible cross-section stowaway. This is another beautiful box. It's got that, I don't know what to call it, that beautiful... Microsoft made some really, really nice boxed software back in the days. This one's actually sealed. It's crushed in like crazy on the back, but I don't really care. I really, really want to thank listener Thraka for helping me out with this one. The seller only would ship within the United States, so I had to call my friend Thraka to help me out here. I shipped it to his house, and then he reboxed everything and shipped it to me, so he was basically being like a free postal forwarding service. So thank you so much again. I really appreciate it. That's the only reason I was able to find this. So what is The Magic School Bus Explores the Ocean? Well, it's that popular cartoon from the 90s, very super nerdy about science and stuff like that. And I don't know. It doesn't look super great, but honestly, I'm a sucker for anything oceanic in theme, as friend of the podcast Ben knows. So as you can see, I'm trying to make fairly strategic buys these days. Most of them are organized around finding fairly obscure edutainment and game preservation, box software that I can write episodes about. I did have a few more scores, and I think two or three of them are arriving in the mail today. I won't talk about those until the next episode, because those are, they're interesting finds of their own. Okay, so that's enough of rooting around in my inventory pack. On to our main topic, After Dark by Berkeley Systems. If you want a little history of screensavers themselves and screensavers in general, you'll want to tune in to around the halfway point of episode 10 on the Simpsons screensaver. That's where I talk about screensavers, where they came from, how we got to After Dark in the first place. For this episode, I'm focusing purely on the years in which After Dark was created and its eventual sale of the company Berkeley Systems to Sierra. Yes, Sierra Online. And in other words, this is purely a development history episode of its own. So the development of After Dark is really the culmination of two very different software development companies. There is the well-known Berkeley Systems, who's Patrick Beard. I'm assuming your name, Patrick, is Beard and not Bayard, because I didn't see an accent aigu over the E. But if it is, I apologize. I'm going to call you Patrick Beard because you're an American, and I assume Americans are non-French. that's a terrible assumption, but that's what I'm going with. Patrick Beard joined up with Jack Eastman to market a little screen drawing program, and that little screen drawing program would eventually become combined with a lesser known company. That screen drawing program by Berkeley Systems, the companies would kind of merge together a little bit with another lesser known company called Dynamic Information Systems, or later known as Dynamic Karma. That was a duo of Bill Stewart and Ian McDonald, who created a fully featured magic screensaver. And that screensaver was already being sold as a kind of form of shareware on the early internet back in the day. So keep in mind, these are two different stories that are getting weaved together. One about Berkeley Systems and the After Dark program that Jack Eastman and Patrick Beard worked on. And there's also the story of Bill Stewart and Ian McDonald creating Magic Screensaver. When those two meet, we get what we know as After Dark. I've done my best to disentangle the parts of After Dark that belong to Jack Eastman and Patrick Beard from the parts that belong to Bill Stewart and Ian McDonald as best I can. But yes, those are two very different histories that are going to kind of get smushed together into one program. It's amazing to see just how well these two different projects were eventually amalgamated into the After Dark that we came to know in the 90s. They both had very different origins, and this is because they were developed on two completely different architectures. Jack Eastman's, I call it Jack Eastman's After Dark engine, but it's really not that. It was just Jack Eastman's screensaving program, modular screensaving program engine. It had its roots in the early 512K Macintosh and the Motorola 68K processor. While Bill Stewart and Ian McDonald's Magic Screensaver was actually developed for an early version of Microsoft Windows. So you have one built for the Intel PC, and specifically for Windows using Windows API calls. Another built for the 512K Macintosh using the Apple's API calls for the Mac. And eventually those two deviating paths are going to meet together, produce a third product that really honestly brought out the best of both worlds. And this is just for me, because I'm a Mac user and I also use Windows, you know, let's say 50-50 for my development work, it blows me away that After Dark was cross-compatible, cross-compiled for those years. It came out for both the Mac and Windows, and they were completely different, API calls to develop those. So let's start by looking at the story of Jack Eastman and Berkeley Systems. This little subsection I call the early origins of After Dark for the Macintosh specifically. Well, the After Dark engine, and I call this engine because it really is, let's say, almost like a game engine, was the brainchild of programmer Jack Eastman. Jack was born in 1960 in Huntington Beach, California, which is kind of a stone's throw from Los Angeles. He was a graduate of the Bachelor of Physics program at UC San Diego. That's University of California, San Diego. He soon found himself in the middle of completing a PhD in high energy particle physics at UC Berkeley, part of the UC chain of universities in the late 1980s. As we can imagine, that's a pretty math heavy concentration at the graduate level. So it's of no surprise that Jack found himself learning graphics programming on the newly released Macintosh. I believe that would be the Mac 512. At first, the graphics programming had an educational application. He wrote a program that drew Feynman diagrams for his doctoral thesis. And if you're wondering what a Feynman diagram is, it's, or is it Feynman? Could be Feynman. I'm not sure which. It's a visual representation of the interaction between subatomic particles over time. It sort of looks like a circuit diagram, except instead of just having structural components relate to each other, it shows how things change over time. You don't really need to know that. I had to look it up, so I just found it interesting. Well, at the same time, Scientific American, the journal/magazine, had published articles on algorithms for simple screen animations like falling raindrops, expanding ripples of water, and expanding starfield simulations. Well, these visualizations sure sound, to me at least, a lot more fun than working on Feynman diagrams. Not only did Jack get these visualizations working on the Macintosh, but he began modifying and extending them into more sophisticated visual experiences. And it was around then that he decided he wanted to see these visualizations play out on his Mac as a screensaver. At the time, the Mac did in fact have a screensaver. It was a single program called Pyro! Which showed fireworks. Jack wanted a screensaver that you could, and I quote, change the channel with. That is, you could cycle between different visualizations for the different graphics algorithms that he was messing around with. And by graphics algorithms, I really do mean kind of procedurally creating geometric shapes on the screen. So when we say raindrops, we're talking about, let's say, a big slash of a vector graphic drawn across the screen. These are not bitmapped. Oops, my bad. I just bumped my mic. The early Mac was pretty famous for its brutal support for third-party programming. There were very few high-level language compilers available, and the ones that did exist, for instance, Pascal, were known to have extremely buggy compilers, and they were not the most stable things to develop with. Worse, there were no APIs or hooks into the application programming interfaces. For let's say the non-programmers out there, when you program a closed source system, meaning you don't have the underlying source code to the system, you need a way to be able to use some of the built-in functions that the system has. So for instance, if you want to make a circle, I don't know, in the Windows Graphics API, there's probably an API called DrawCircle. So it's like a function you can tap into, pass it a couple of parameters like the size of the circle or maybe the color of the circle and whether it's filled or not filled. And the Windows API will take in that input and make a circle on the screen. Well, the Macintosh had some of those, but only a very limited amount, and they weren't well documented. And so things you could not do via API were things like intercepting mouse movement. There was no API to know where your mouse was on the screen in relation to some point. And writing to the display was actually really difficult. So that draw circle API actually didn't really exist very easily for the Mac. So like many programmers of the mid-1980s, especially for the Mac, Jack was forced to start coding close to the metal, as we say. That is, writing Motorola 68000 assembly language code for the Mac. I probably could do a whole episode on assembly language of its own, even though I know very little about it. When we say close to the metal, the idea is you're no longer using these APIs, application programming interfaces, to communicate with the operating system. You're actually programming the processor directly. So in order to A, get his graphics showing up on the screen, and B, getting them to show fast enough, you would want to make use of the assembly language commands that the Motorola 68K had. And the advantage was the Motorola 68K, I'm not sure why I'm having trouble saying that one today, was very well documented. So you could actually, now you can't just have a draw circle command for the CPU, but you could, let's say, create your own circle drawing routine or program that you could call over and over and over to draw circles on the screen. So, having a handful of graphics routines that he wanted to turn into a screensaver gave him an idea. Instead of writing, let's say, bespoke, that is, handwritten assembly for each screensaver routine, and then copying that same code to other screensaver, why not write a modular style of code that you could plug in different graphics routines into the base system. So again, when you write that assembly language code for something as simple as putting a pixel on the screen, you don't want to tell it to draw a pixel here and then another one at this location, another at this location, and do them one at a time. You can turn that pixel drawing routine into, let's say, something like bitblit. Blit a bit at this spot in memory. And then you can call bitblit as much as you want. What he was trying to do was be able to feed it a bunch of graphics information, graphics data, and have it paint to the screen that way. In effect, Jack was talking about writing a screensaver engine for the Macintosh. He writes, "So whatever we did to detect mouse motion, to black out the screen, to put a display reliably on top of everything else," when he says display here, I mean window, "that had to be done despite what the operating system was trying to do on its own. That meant we had to patch or hack the operating system itself. By the time I was done, I had 93 patches on the operating system." That would be probably Mac, a very early version of Mac OS. So it started as a fun graphics programming project turned into a very complicated OS hack. Then I circled back and wrote a modular programming interface for the screensaver modules themselves. So again, this is basically Jack saying, you know what I created? I created a screensaver API for the Macintosh. Jack credits Patrick Beard for helping him figure out some of the nastier portions of that 68K programming for the Mac. And I assume that also means, dealing with the operating system calls too. Jack's relationship with Patrick Beard would prove even more fruitful soon afterwards. But before we get into that nitty-gritty of how Jack's screensaver engine became the foundation for After Dark, we kind of need to fly about 1,600 kilometers north of Berkeley, California to Alberta, Canada, where two programmers were about to release a new kind of shareware into the online world for the Windows platform. This little subsection I tried to call the Origins of After Dark for Windows. The tiny software development studio, then known as Dynamic Information Systems, operated out of a 1980s wooden brick bungalow, I would say very typical of the Canadian prairies, in a middle-class neighborhood in the city of Calgary. If you're as old as I am, you might recognize that name. The city of Calgary was still living kind of on a high from the prior year when it hosted the 1988 Winter Olympic Games. And this would be famed for its enormous ski jumps that still remain to this day along the north slopes of the hills at Canada Olympic Park. Although this is rarely credited publicly, Bill Stewart and Ian McDonald's, the owners of this company, created the first screensaver for Microsoft Windows. That is, Windows 2.0 back in 1989. This would be a year after the Olympics. Back then, Windows wasn't quite the fully featured OS that we recognize today. Sure, there were a few familiar, friendly faces that survived for many years, like Reverse, Terminal, Write, and Paint.exe. But for the most part, Windows 2.0 felt a lot like the, if you're familiar with this, Xerox Alto user interface that inspired it. This would be the UI that not only Microsoft kind of copied or stole, but it was also the UI that Apple stole from the Macintosh. The Windows 2.0 UI was blocky, painfully slow for most users, including me. My family at the time owned an 8 megahertz 8086. It came with Windows 2.0 as part of the Amstrad PC suite of software that you got with the computer. Windows 2.0, I don't think anybody would call an operating system. This was more just a graphical shell for MS-DOS. And honestly, it's probably not a graphical shell that you want to be programming natively in. Basically, its API calls were pretty rough and pretty slow. And yet, that's exactly what Bill and Ian were trying to do. Magic Screensaver began its life as a programming experiment. They really wanted to know how to write a window for, how to write a program for Windows 2.11 at the time. After all, Writing a native screensaver for Windows 2 was a fairly difficult programming prospect. Microsoft Visual Basic at the time was still targeting MS-DOS, and the only real option was to write native C using Microsoft C versions 4 and 5, and then you would hook that code into the Windows 2 application programming interfaces, or APIs, as we talked about earlier. The difficulty in this, as Jack Eastman found out with the early Macintosh, was that the Windows 2.0 APIs were written mostly for productivity applications. You might put some text on a draggable window. You might let the user modify that text and spit that data out to a file or a printer. You know, basic productivity stuff that we would expect out of a spreadsheet. Graphics routines were not a major part of the API specification, because in those years, who would really need real-time graphics display in, 1989? Well, games, surely, but that wasn't really the purpose of the API, and this also accounts why there were so few games for the Windows platform until DirectX was released. It also meant access to some fairly low-level stuff that APIs aren't generally written to handle. These are things like screen blanking procedures, sound and graphics interrupts, cursor movement, and the kind of stuff routinely used in MS-DOS was not as easy to hook into in Windows 2 APIs. That would eventually change with the release of WinG, that's the Windows graphics APIs in Windows 3.1. Even then, it's pretty tough stuff. But this early on, Magic Screensaver really was magic to the average Windows 2.1 user that played the occasional game of Reversi now and then. Bill and Ian thought Magic Screensaver was so cool that they say they posted it on the early internet. No, not the World Wide Web that we know today. This is pre-web. But the pre-web internet that consisted of things like WASE, Archie, Gopher, Usenet, email servers. I wasn't able to find out exactly where Magic Screensaver was first released. I suspect it was probably released onto one of the many public FTP, public anonymous FTP sites at the time. That being said, there's no mention of the internet at all in the README of the first version of the program that was released. You'd expect, some kind of university-owned email address, something like, Ian at ucalgary.ca. That wasn't there. Instead, what I found were two online addresses that you could write to the authors, one on CompuServe via an online service called Connect, and on an American AOL address. No, not an at AOL.com address. I mean America Online address, pre-AOL internet. So it's likely that this program was initially making its rounds on early online services before it actually made its way to the internet. I guarantee this was showing up on BBSs at the time, because that would be a very popular way of getting your computer online. The first public release that I could find was version 1.02, released on June 8th, 1990. That's about 30 years ago to anyone listening in 2020. And it has some great technical information included in the README. Basically, it tells you how the program works. And I quote here, Magic installs a journal hook using Magic's DLL to monitor the keyboard, mouse movements, and mouse location. Then a timer is created to measure periodicity of inactivity, the mouse's duration in the sleep area, and the animation of the Nova icon when active. That's a bit of a description from Bill and Ian. Then they go on to kind of describe how Magic works. Well, Magic works in early versions of Windows by examining the Windows system message queue. That is a part of the resource sharing that lets Windows applications run alongside each other. So if you're wondering about how Windows 3.1 kind of managed multitasking, it was via this message queuing system. When the system message queue is empty, that is, it's full of null messages from these programs. So basically, if I'm a program running and I don't need to do any CPU intensive task work, I'm just idling, I send a null message to the system message queue. Well, Magic Screensaver picks that up. It sees all these null messages in the queue, and it's allowed to take over the shell and then kick in the graphics routines it has, so we get a nice screensaver on the display. So basically, it's waiting for those null messages on the queue, that is, everything's idling, to take it over. To disable Magic Screensaver and free up some system resources, you just click a power switch in the program's control panel. This is something I'm sure you are very familiar with if you have ever seen the After Dark control panel. It has exactly the same behavior. There's even a system lock password that engages when somebody wakes up the screensaver. Another feature, you know, integrated into After Dark years later. There's a sleep preview window that shows you exactly what the currently selected screensaver graphics will look like, so you even get a little bit of a preview. If any of this sounds familiar, the cursor sleep area, a timer that monitors mouse movement, power switch toggle, system password, all of these UI and UX features would become core to After Dark. Now, being shareware, Bill and Ian asked only that if users enjoyed the program and used it for more than 15 days, that they pay a modest fee of $20 via snail mail. Voluntary registration entitled a user to future updates of the Magic Screensaver and access to the SDK. Yes, another of the features that we'd see in After Dark was access to an SDK that allowed users to write their own graphics modules that didn't need to be first-party licensed or, you know, written in-house. It's not really clear if any third-party Magic Screensaver modules were ever released. I actually could not find the SDK anywhere. That's not to say it doesn't exist, but I couldn't find any evidence of any plugins for it. Magic Screensaver would get several revisions over the next 11 years. Yes, 11 years. That's a long lifetime for a single screensaver product. Eventually including 32-bit support for Windows 95 to 2000. Magic was eventually sold, commercially using a sliding site licensing fee. That is, individuals, you and me, would pay a different price than corporations like, Microsoft, that wanted a site license to cover every head in their building. Eventually, Bill and Ian would drop the licensing requirement and give it away as freeware, or perhaps more accurately, postcardware. By version 1.6, released in late September of 2000, this meant that if you wanted to, if you show your appreciation for running Magic Screensaver, you could send a postcard to their business address, which was relocated from Calgary to Victoria, British Columbia. I thought that was really cool. But that's getting a little ahead of ourselves. How did Magic Screensaver get wrapped into the Berkeley After Dark suite? For that, we have to weave in the history of the entire team at Berkeley Systems. And here's our little subsection on After Dark 1.0. So let's wind the clock back to the late 1980s. This would be a year or two before Jack Eastman began toying around with his modular screensaving engine. And, you know, a year or two before Bill Stewart and Ian McDonald released Magic Screensaver. The company, as we know it, consisted of a half dozen employees crammed into the attic of an old Victorian house in the small city of Berkeley, California. The office was itself accessible only by a sharply angled set of stairs that resembled a ladder more than they did a staircase. That little startup was called Berkeley Systems. Berkeley Systems was developing and publishing at the time a virtual desktop program called Stepping Out. The idea was that by moving your mouse to the edge of the screen, the desktop would pan to reveal even more real estate. This is something we've come to take for granted in Linux, Windows, Mac OS, but in the mid-1980s, virtual desktop technology was let's admit it, totally unprecedented. Stepping Out turned out to be a niche product. At the time, 512K of RAM was standard on the Macintosh, and you can imagine how much video memory was required to be able to extend that desktop past its, you know, normal size. Berkeley Systems was also working on a couple of accessibility utilities for the Macintosh. In Large, was a screen magnifier application meant as a visual aid on the Mac for those with vision issues. Outspoken provided spoken UI cues for the blind. While both of these utilities would take nearly 20 years to actually become integrated parts of modern operating system as accessibility features, they were unfortunately too ahead of their time for the original Macintosh and also for the wrong hardware. You see, in 1988, the Mac still enjoyed only a 4% market share in the personal computer market. Compare that to IBM PC and its many clones that chewed up 80% of the same market at the time. By 1989, around the year that Berkeley Systems had introduced their accessibility and desktop utilities, the Mac's market share had only grown from 4% to about 6%. So think about the economics of this. Of the total number of PC users, only 6% of those had compatible Macs. Of those 6%, a tiny fraction of them might need a screen magnifier or spoken UI cues. Sadly, this meant that Berkeley Systems, even though they had, you know, these ahead of their time programs that were tremendously useful for people who needed them, they just weren't selling. Well, in comes Jack Eastman's screen-saving modular screensaver program, which did not even have a name at that point. When he had a working prototype of the screensaver and a few visualization modules, he passed a copy on to his friend Patrick. Well, at the time, Patrick was working for, and this is Patrick Beard, Patrick was working for Berkeley Systems, helping to write these software operating system utilities. One of the two Berkeley Systems owners, Wes Boyd, saw the screensaver running on Patrick's computer one day and asked him for the original programmer's number. After some back and forth over the phone with Jack, Wes Boyd offered to publish the screensaver suite under the Berkeley Systems banner if Jack agreed to give the program some commercial polish. The Berkeley Systems programming team, along with Jack, I think he was hired as the VP of engineering or something at the time. I'm sorry, that's off the top of my head. It's in one of my notes I don't have in front of me. Set to work on refining and extending his prototype. The engine's calls were standardized, and then they added additional modules to it for a total of 15 different screensavers. Originally titled Nightlife, perhaps in a nod to its Starry Night module, Berkeley Systems soon found out that the name was unfortunately already in use. After Dark was actually their second choice for a name. After Dark 1.0 made a quiet debut at the Macworld 89 Expo in Washington, D.C. Lacking a booth of their own, the Berkeley team sublet a tiny corner of a mail order company's gigantic booth. The little corner booth that they kind of sublet from them held two Berkeley employees and a Macintosh proudly displaying After Dark version 1.0. While passing conference attendees liked what they saw, it didn't exactly sell like hotcakes. So, back to the drawing board for version 2.0. Wes Boyd felt the reason why this didn't quite catch on was that the program needed a bit of a stronger artistic push, something that would really draw the eye in. The line drawings, while capable, still had a bit of the programmer art look to them. Keep in mind that these are, you know, the same algorithms that came out of Scientific American, you know, months earlier. Well, the reason why they have that bit of a line art look to them is because After Dark 1.0 was all vector art based. There wasn't a single bitmapped image used in the program. Jack took After Dark back home after getting some advice from Wes and began work on some new modules for version 2. One late night, while his wife was working the graveyard shift at the hospital, Jack began ruminating on some fun and eye-catching ideas for a new module. He writes, "I drifted into the kitchen and the toaster caught my eye. My sleep-deprived brain put wings on it. I went upstairs and drew some animation frames. I used the development system's icon editor to do this. Little white outline toasters on a black background with little stubby plucked chicken wings, speed lines, and a flapping electrical cord. I coded up the animation that night and brought it to Berkeley Systems the next day. Everyone thought it was hilarious, and everybody agreed that it needed to be redrawn." That little animation of a flying toaster would become the foundation for After Dark 2.0. For version 2, the engine would be rewritten to hook up with modules written in the C programming language. Wes Boyd would bring in a professional artist to re-render those flying toasters in something a little bit more eye-catching than line drawings. After Dark 2.0 added a control panel for the modules, a nice little feature there from Magic Screensaver, and Jack insisted that the flying toaster module needed a slider that controlled the doneness of the toast. A feature that, to this day, still absolutely delights me. 2.0 also made pseudo-random number generation and procedural generation endemic to the program. Jack's experience with Monte Carlo simulations in his physics graduate work had taught him how to generate random numbers, that is, pseudo-random numbers, in different kinds of distributions. If you're a game developer or a coder of any kind, one of the most interesting things you'll find out is that pseudo-random number generators do not produce very interesting or very enjoyable random number sequences. They're random, or they're at least pseudo-random. But in terms of visuals and game playing, they're not very enjoyable. They just kind of look like static on the screen. So he found a way to get around that by working with population distributions, that is, something like a bell curve. Generate me a random distribution of numbers, most of which that fall within, you know, a certain range, and very few of which fall outside of that range. So that created some patterned randomness to the flight of the flying toasters. Even to this day, there is still something extremely pleasant about watching flying toasters. That's something that, according to Jack, competing screensavers didn't have and became a part of what I would like to call the Berkeley Systems magic. After Dark 2.0 shipped with the standard 15 screensavers. That was, you know, that was the magic number that Berkeley gave to producing the right number of modules for the product. Among those, Starry Night and Fish were on the top. Fish was an aquarium simulator that, to this day, still looks absolutely stunning on a color monitor. Many third-party screensavers would try to emulate Fish, but never quite demonstrate the same attention to detail, customizability, and honestly, a really solid pseudo-random number generator to produce random but enjoyable randomness. The box art would be completely redone by co-owner Joan Blade, giving it a lot more shelf appeal at computer stores. And this is something that I saw over and over and over in interviews, that people were really blown away by the improvement in the quality of the box design. A Windows version made by Ian and Bill was also released simultaneously, matching kind of punch for punch the Macintosh version. If version 1 got Berkeley Systems feet wet, let's say it sold a few, the sales of version 2 of After Dark was like a torrential rain pour. The company quickly staffed up to meet the demand and began work on version 3. After Dark version 3 would be released in 1994, just prior to The Simpsons screensaver, featuring a mix of classics like flying toasters, a fake DOS shell, which is quite funny, flying toilets, riffing on their own signature logo, and so on. One interesting change was that in later versions of After Dark, let's say around the 3.0 time, it became less and less important to have a black background with, you know, sprites or vectors moving across it. That's because monitor technology had changed significantly enough to make it possible to use static images and bright colors on a screen without causing burn-in. In other words, a screensaver by the mid-1990s, per se, wasn't really necessary anymore, and it became a purely visual experience and toy for the screen with lots of eye-catching artistic fancy. With that became the fact that the modules became more brightly colored, more beautiful. They also became sillier over time. By the mid-90s, these modules would fully embrace the Berkeley system's quirky sense of humor. Totally Twisted After Dark, which deserves an episode of its own, was a perfect example of the team's sense of humor by the mid-90s. The last version of After Dark we'd see was released as version 4.0 in 1996. And this is where things kind of take a terrible, sad downturn. After Dark disappears. In 1997, Berkeley Systems was making in excess of $30 million a year. It had 120 employees. And that year, they would be sold to the Sierra branch or arm of CUC International. If you recognize that name, it's because it's the parent company that had purchased Sierra Online from the Williamses earlier. After the CUC International investment fraud debacle, Sierra and Berkeley Systems were sold to Vivendi, who in turn saw no commercial future for screensavers and turned Berkeley Systems into a banner ad management business. And this would be, I think, around late 1998, 99. And then in early 2000s, Berkeley Systems would be further denigrated by being folded into a gambling site called iWin.com that Vivendi had recently purchased. So there's our end of a wonderful piece of technology and history. A little bit on tech stuff. I had intended on going into a lot more detail with this, but it just couldn't happen. You can actually write your own After Dark modules. Berkeley Systems supplied their own SDK or software development kit and encouraged fans to create their own modules. They even held competitions. Some of those modules that won the competitions ended up in the official After Dark, I think it's 4.0 releases. Officially, After Dark modules for the Macintosh can be written in either a variant of Pascal or C using the Berkeley Systems SDK. I also found there's a great Windows After Dark programming page that describes the Windows API along with supplying all of the tools you need to develop your own thing. So if you want to do something really cool, maybe this is a fun future project for me someday, maybe I should make my own screensaver for Windows 3.1 for the show and release it. And just a final note here, bibliography, I'm not sure what to call this, references, thank yous. I need to thank Tommy Thomas of Low End Mac and Raphael Rosendahl of the Sleep Mode art exhibit for the bulk of the interviews used in this history. I also rely upon Bill Stewart's insider accounts of the Magic Screensaver via his website. And a big thank you to the WinWorld PC website, which is a massive repository of early Windows artifacts, software artifacts, many of which I used in researching this episode. So that's the end, as far as I know, of the history of Berkeley Systems and After Dark. If you have any memories of using After Dark modules, or if you want me to do a whole episode on a module that you really like, please let me know, and I'll be happy to kind of start the research process and start the writing process. That's it for this episode of Multimedia Hyperguide. I'm looking forward to speaking to you again very, very soon. My next episode is likely going to be a DOS prompt episode because I've been dying to do some DOS history. So keep an eye out for that soon. I'm not going to make any promises about the timing, but so far things are looking pretty good for an episode in the next few weeks. Oh, there you go. I just said it. I almost half promised something. Take care, folks. Talk to you again soon.